saying you have to vote up, so.
So they can't vote no on 9:41. So I got a whole list.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the May 4th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. Got a number of bills up today, and we're going to start off with House Bill 2559A. James.
What controversy there?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2559A prohibits person conveying fee title to real property from including an instrument provision prohibiting installation and use of solar panels on residential lots. Declares provision and declaration or bylaws of planned community or condominium prohibiting owner from installing or using solar panels as void and unenforceable. Specifies owner as person who owns roof or other exterior portion of building or improvement on which solar panels would be installed. Allows owner of record or property to file petition to remove such provision. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact, and it has a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Representatives. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Greenlux, House District 33, and I'm pleased that you had this hearing today. It's a rather simple bill. The a constituent of mine and a constituent of my representative colleague here, two different constituents, wanted to put solar panels on their home in a planned unit that had a homeowners association. Homeowners Association said no. This bill says that's not good public policy, and it adds to the things that a homeowner association cannot do. It adds one more thing. It cannot stop a resident of that association who owns his or her own roof from putting solar panels on the roof under the design considerations that the homeowners association can put on it. It's very straightforward. We hope that you'll move it forward again. And one of my constituents is here to testify on his story as well.
Okay.
Thank you for hearing this bill. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. I wanted to just add a couple of things to what Representative Greenlick has already told you. The own roof provision is very important, because otherwise you might find yourself trying to install or having an owner try to install solar panels on a condominium in a big building downtown Portland. This bill does not do that. It only applies to essentially buildings in which the owner of the structure also owns the roof and is asking for doing it, but they're subject to the homeowners association rules. I think it's important also to note that this does not prevent the design committee in such an association from imposing design restrictions that are reasonable, that would be intended to conform to the design in the community. A number of communities have rather strict design rules that this would only interfere with in the slight way, in that it would allow the installation of solar panels. Questions came up in the House on this bill having to do with where these solar panels could be placed, and it's my intention to present the committee with an amendment that would insert the restriction that is already in place in the laws that refer to zoning and construction done by cities and counties rather than homeowners association. And that restriction says the installation of a solar energy system can be accomplished without increasing the footprint of the residential structure or the peak height of the portion of the roof on which the system is installed, making it extremely clear we're talking about the roof, not something else, and making it also clear that it can't hang out over the edges, again, unless the design committee and the homeowners association approve. Obviously, the homeowners association and the owner can agree to anything they want to outside of this bill if that's agreeable to them. This simply restricts what the homeowners association is able to prevent. And that's all. We think that we're to the stage in the development of renewable power in Oregon and distributed power where the policy of the state of Oregon should be that a homeowner in a condominium association or a planned unit Association should be able to install solar panels in a reasonable way that meets with design specifications on their own roof. The amendment in the House simply said this also applies to the ones you lease from somebody like Solar World. That's the only change that the House made in the original bill. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
And we talked to the representative about having car charging stations as a part of the same.
So I guess the key phrase here is in Section 3, which talks about an owner who owns the roof or exterior portions of a building. So in the case, certainly it wouldn't apply to a multi-tenant building.
That's correct.
Couldn't apply to that. And it really would depend on how the homeowner association was structured. You have a lot of them that have duplexes or even single families where you own the inside, but all the exteriors are the same. And so in those cases, usually the association is the owner of the exterior.
It depends on. I've had two different condos in Palm Springs, and one of the associations, the homeowner owned the roof and was responsible for its maintenance. And the other one, the next one I had, the roof was a part of the common property, and yeah. the association was responsible for maintaining the roof.
So this would only apply where they.
This would only be in the first
case. You actually
case.
Own it. Okay. Good. Senator.
I have hundreds of questions. This might take all afternoon.
We're going to limit some of that, but they're going to, regardless of your questions, I think they're going to go charging out of here.
I'd rather be here than on the floor.
Okay.
Just in most of those associations, they're controlled by boards, and if the folks in the community want something different, they petition the board, go to the meetings. And try to talk the board into the new ideas. Are people not able to do that want to do this? I mean, it would seem to me, other words, if you want to keep peace in the neighborhood, you do it through your association instead of
well,
state.
Well, it simultaneously arose in Eugene and in the Portland area just at the same time. The fact is that we restrict what a homeowners association can restrict as a matter of public policy. Yeah. Like, they can't put in amendments that you can't sell your house to a black person or something like that. This is a matter of public policy. It says it's good public policy to have alternative energy sources, and adds that, I think it's the third restriction in Section 1, that adds that as a matter of public policy. So, yes, in many homeowners associations, this isn't a problem. It turns out in some it is a problem, and we're suggesting as a matter of public policy that solar panels are a good idea.
If I may add, Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, I think that's right. I think the vast majority of homeowners associations, based on a completely unscientific knowledge of, based on anecdotal information, would have no problem with this bill because they were going to behave that way anyway. I think it would be the unusual one where the effect of it is to prevent a homeowner from making his or her contribution toward the renewable energy, and in many cases, actually reducing their own electrical costs.
You're not going to suggest to me that life in a condominium association is just wonderful.
No, I'm not going to suggest that.
I'm sorry. Did you have more, Senator Thompson?
99 more.
99 more?
You'll
pass?
Yeah, I'll.
You'll
I'll,
yield
I'll
at this point. Great. Okay.
Darn.
Senator Girardi, yeah. He yields to you.
The obvious question is these people bought these units and they signed off on the CC&Rs that basically said you will not do this. So why come back later and then say, well, I'm sorry, we're going to void that contract? That's what you're doing. And it's not predicated on energy or policy. It's predicated on cosmetics. They want a special look in these units.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Hi, Chair Grad. I don't think the CC&Rs forbid solar panels. I think it comes up as a matter of request from an association member, and the panel, I mean, and the homeowners association, probably the design committee, says, no, you can't do it. So, yeah, if it was in the CC&Rs, I would say that would be a whole different story. But It's never been any of the CCNRs that I've read. It's just a matter of decision. Like the same decision in my condo that I couldn't have a stool outside my door to pick up my paper.
But this bill, if it, it doesn't it, if it's in the CCNRs, this says that you can't have it in the CCNRs.
Yes. This bill would prevent them from either putting in the CCRs or imposing that decision outside of the CCNRs.
Right.
But I don't think you'll find the Homeowners Association of CCNRs that forbids solar panels. I think that would be a different argument, and that's not been the case with either of our.
And if I could add to that, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Girod, the design committees in most of these associations have enormous discretionary authority. In the ones I'm thinking about, they dictate the color of the main color of the house. Mm-hmm. They dictate whether or not you can have a clothesline. They dictate how whether you put a rock wall around the building or not. They dictate what kind of plantings you can have. The one I'm thinking of specifically required a cedar roof until the fire in Sisters, when all the cedar roofed houses burned down and the metal roofed ones did not. And the next day, the design committee forbade cedar roofs and started to require metal roofs. So they have huge discretionary power. All this does is reduce one piece of that discretion. That's it.
I'm a no.
Senator Monroe?
Do you know of any CCRs that currently forbid solar panels?
I don't think so.
I don't.
Okay, so this is all prospective.
This is all prospective.
Else? Thank you, gentlemen. We'll let you get back to your wonderful debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And let's see. Jerry Weiner? Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Weinert. I live in 1614 Northwest 143rd Avenue, Portland, Oregon. I'm representing myself as an owner of a townhouse in a planned community called Mill Ridge Townhouses, located on Northwest 143rd Avenue. Thank you for all the work you people have done on the bill, and I'm very satisfied with it. I'll just give you an example, though, of my case, where I applied for solar through the Architectural Control Committee, and they immediately fired it back and just said no. So I'm stuck. I brought forth the current legislation that we have on solar, and they said, well, this talks about solar in a provision. Our decks do not say you cannot have solar. And the lawyer for the association said, just because the association decks don't prohibit you from solar doesn't mean you're allowed to have solar. So that's where I'm stuck now, is the architectural committee said, no, you may not have solar. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
So I'm curious. You used the term, you own a townhouse.
Yes.
Townhouses are usually multiple units.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are.
A common roof. How would you do? How would this work for that? Do you own?
The units are of different size, and therefore the roofs are individual. So they're definitely delineated. I presented all the designs and documents to the Architectural Control Committee, and I don't know if they understood them or not. I was open for questions. They wanted to have a closed meeting. Fine. So the answer came back with a no. No reason why they were denied, but just a plain no.
Mm. But the roofs, you own the roof, though?
Yes.
Senator Girod?
Do you face south?
East and west. It's a very economical energy provider. I had the...
So you'd put solar panels on both sides?
Yes.
You don't think that that would affect the cosmetics of everybody else's units?
You know, not officially from the architectural committee, but general rumors said aesthetically we don't want solar.
Okay.
So, are you responsible for replacing the roof on your unit?
I am not responsible for replacing the roof. The association is responsible for the exterior maintenance of the buildings.
Ooh. That was my only question.
Yeah. So this bill won't help you?
No. The only reason it won't help is because it's addressing the instruments and the conveyance. It's talking about the written documents. I would like to have something where the bill included, maybe through legislative intent, that says that the intent is that you are allowed to have solar and the association is not allowed to block it.
Well, this doesn't do that.
Excuse me?
I don't think this does that.
That's correct, Chair Breyer.
Okay.
Others?
But if we can get a legal opinion or legislative intent in there to explain it further, that might do it.
Well, I think your problem, if this were to pass, I think your problem is my guess is the way you've described it is you don't own the roof.
Right. I do own the roof legally. We've gone through that.
Really? But they're responsible for maintenance.
They're responsible for maintenance on anything exterior.
That's weird.
They've been trying to revise the decks and bylaws for many years, but these are written in 69.
So
that's very different than what I'm used to. In most of them, it's you can drive the nail, but depending on where it goes from the inside, once you hit the outside, you don't own that.
One more.
You own it in common, I should say, with everybody else.
Comment, if I may. In my homeowner association, we had a gentleman who wanted to put on comp roof instead of the cedar, and was told no, and so he ran for president of the board and won, and got the rule changed and then resigned. Have you thought about doing that?
I've had the pleasure of being the president for almost 6 years.
Well,
and excluded you from the meeting still?
I'm not the president currently. However, the Architectural Control Committee is the first stop that does the recommending. And if it doesn't pass there, typically the board will acknowledge what the committee said.
Okay.
Familiar with that. Senator.
My question is, how many years have you been trying to get this in your homeowners?
This, we're going on the second year now.
I would assume it's really a new problem because people weren't doing it before the last 4 or 5 years, to any great degree, some, but very few. So my guess would be there are virtually no homeowners association decks that address this issue.
The city of Ashland and the city of Medford and homeowners association, I've got letters from the one, they had to go to court. But they got approval to get their solar panel in there.
Was that with a city ordinance? Was that through city ordinances?
This was through the association themselves trying to use, I believe it was Ashland's city ordinances, and the homeowners association said no. They went to court. And, excuse me. They were suing to go to court. It never went to court. The homeowners association changed their mind.
Okay. That's a different thing. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2559A? What, no realtors? It's surprising. Okay. Ready to do this one? Let me close it first. We'll close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2559A. Discussion. Oh, I guess we have to have a motion first. Chair moves approval of the bill as presented. Put the due pass to the floor. I got to get my terminology right today. I'm not in the groove yet.
There's nothing in there about water damage. If you're putting something up on the roof and you drill a hole through the roof, and it's a roof in common, or if it's a separate roof, who's going to be responsible for the water damage? That's not in the bill.
No, but it's in the contracts for the people who put the solar panels up.
But these are on roofs. This only applies to your roof.
That you own.
You own. So if there's any water damage, it's going to be...
You know, they're trying to get a look. That's what they're trying to have here. That's why they all want the same shakes. And then they decide, you know, that it's all about the look. And the CC&Rs, and what you're trying to do is overrule the CC&Rs, and that's a private contract. Yeah. And it has nothing to do with public policy. Absolutely nothing.
Considering what we learned last week, there is the issue of a contract as a contract. But there is precedent of public policy.
Why don't we just say that Democrats can live there?
I like that.
Yeah, I figured you might. That's why I think we have those.
Other discussion? Is there opposition to the motion? Oh, we have two.
Oh, gee, surprise.
Is there any other opposition to the motion? Okay, so the House Bill 2559A moves to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation with Senators Thompson and Girard in opposition. And Carrier, anybody want to... Do you want to carry it, Rod?
Sure.
Senator Monroe wants to carry. So we'll close on that. And where do we want to go from here? We want to go to 3035?
Correct.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3035. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3035 expands allowable use of flashing lights in school zones where a school parking lot is located across the street from the school on a street with a posted speed limit of 45 miles per hour or greater. There are no amendments, no revenue impact, and has a minimal fiscal impact.
And let's see, Commissioner Cameron and friends.
This is...
Welcome.
It's good to be here today.
Today. Well, we like you back anytime, yeah. Kevin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's good to be in here with you today, not on the House floor.
Yeah, yeah. It's a better place to be today.
I'm not 100% sure.
If it's good to be here. Okay, so for the record, Kevin Cameron, Marion County Commissioner, and I'm here to help testify on House Bill 3035. I know Representative Hack has sponsored the bill. We've worked together on this bill, and her legislative assistant Morgan is here to give some testimony as well. Basically, the issue is that we have a very small school, Cloverdale School. It's built really close to a 55-mile-an-hour highway. Mm. The speed limit on the highway, and across the street from the school is a parking lot. I think it was about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, there was a request by the parents to change from 7 to 5 speed limit signs during school days to flashing lights. What happens is the statute, if you look at it very closely, I couldn't believe this when I looked at it. The statute says you can only flash the lights when the children are scheduled to come or scheduled to leave. So what happens is during the day, between that hour of, you know, 9 o'clock after they get there and 2 o'clock, if there's special occasion for grandparents and parents coming, parking across the street to come, they're dodging 55 mile an hour traffic. And the only other option is go back to 7 to 5. They don't want to do that because of the agricultural traffic that's there. And our public works said we need to change the statute to actually have the signs flash while the school is in session. That's what this does. It's very limited. It's 45 miles or greater on a speed limit issue, and there has to be a parking lot across the street. You won't find too many schools with that situation in the state, although I'm sure there are some, and I know ODOT's here to answer any questions. But I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to come up and testify, and members of the committee, thank you for your service. And I know the tough job you have to do, and I really appreciate y'all doing what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Chair Byers, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Conger. I'm the chief staffer, Representative Jody Hack, who represents House District 19, which includes South Salem, Turner, and Almsville. I'm here today to offer the testimony on behalf of Representative Hack, who's currently in session on the House floor, as all of you are aware. And so I'd just like to read verbatim the testimony, which is as follows. Today I have the pleasure of presenting for your consideration House Bill 3035. I would like to start by once again thanking former Representative and current Marion County Commissioner Kevin Cameron, along with the wonderful parents and teachers of the staff and staff of Cloverdale Elementary, who brought this matter to our attention out of the concern for the safety and well-being of their children and students. Without their efforts, driven by the love for their children of Cloverdale, this bill would not exist. Allow me to provide you some background on this bill. Under the current ORS, a flashing light used as a traffic control device to indicate that children may be arriving at or leaving school may be operated only at times when children are scheduled to arrive at or leave school. In the cases of most schools, this may be a sufficient rule, but there are certain schools where allowing for the school zone lights to flash only at the beginning and end of the school day is not enough to ensure the safety of the students. Cloverdale Elementary is one of those schools. At this elementary school, located in the city of Turner off Parish Gap Road, there is in place a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, which is not sufficiently monitored by law enforcement. To make matters worse, the only parking space available to staff and parents is located across this high-speed road. This means that every man, woman, and child that attends, works at, or visits Cloverdale Elementary will have to pass this hazardous road at least twice a day. Simply put, as it stands, this is a completely unsafe traffic environment for the students of the school and for the other schools across the state that this bill would apply to. That is where House Bill 3035 comes in. Under this bill, a school is located on a street with a high-speed limit of 45 miles an hour or greater, and having their parking lot located across the street will be given the authority to activate the flashing lights indicator from the hours of 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Studies have shown that the drivers respond to the flashing light indicating the presence of a school zone by slowing down to the prescribed speed limit more consistently than if the light was not involved. Members of the committee, this is a simple bill, a bill that has one motive and one motive only, to increase the safety and well-being of our children and students. I believe in this bill, and it will make a positive increase in the level of safety for our schools and that are located to adjacent to hazardous traffic conditions. Thank you for your time. I urge your support.
So, Morgan, is there a flashing light there now? Just as turned off other than in the school transport times. Okay. Senator Thompson and Senator Radley?
No, this will be okay. So, the speed limit is 55 through there.
Yes.
When the lights were flashing, did it go to 20?
Yes.
So now it'll just be 20 all the time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, only when the lights flash is the speed limit 20 miles an hour.
Right.
So the statute today, as I was here in 2000, Chair, you're aware of this. In 2005, we had a big school zone. Senator Riley, you were here, right? So a few of us were here. School zone. The only two options you have today is a sign that says 7 to 5.
Okay.
So you have to go 20 miles an hour from 7 in the morning till 5. We have a school, in fact, the safety individual from Cascade School District's here to testify. We have a school zone where we actually had a death, sad to say. That is now posted from 7 to 5, and that's where you have to abide by that. What we're trying to do is avoid having to go back to that 7 to 5, allow for flashing lights, but allow those lights to go from, say, 8:30 when the kids are arriving till 2:30 or 3 or whenever it is they're going to be gone. And throughout that day, people would be restricted to the 20-mile-an-hour zone. Pretty simple, limited fix. The question from our Public Works Department, because I've been working with them on it, is how well will the batteries work, because those are solar panel issues. So there's obviously a chance to, they're going to have to experiment with that, and if they have a problem, we can always work with the school and get power out there.
Okay. Great.
Thanks. Senator Riley.
Thank you. Welcome, Kevin. It's good to see you back in the building.
It's good to be home.
I'm shocked that we need this bill. It seems to me that a better bill would be to allow the schools to use the lights as they feel they're needed. But I will support this bill, but I think we maybe aren't going far enough. I think there are other schools that will have certain circumstances where the lights could be needed, and I think they should be allowed. So, but I'll support this bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, I fought that too, but then when you dig into this issue a little bit further, Public Works that controls, the schools don't control the flashing lights, it's Public Works that controls, Marion County Public Works controls the flashing lights for all our rural schools. Okay. And I'm not sure about the city, how that works, but you would really run into a lot of problems and frustrations. You're right. Maybe it would be better if they had more control, if they had an evening program or something. But I didn't want to go that way because we needed this fix for a specific situation that we've had a really bad tragedy here in Marion County recently, and we want to make sure we don't have another one of those in this situation. Thank you.
Although I have sympathy with where you're going, because I think you could have events at night, you know, PTA meetings or other things that it may make sense just to have it posted for 20 miles an hour. But I guess we've got this in front of it. We'll deal with this problem now.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I, knowing how difficult it is to get certain things done in this building, I think I would like to recommend you pass this bill, and then you guys can
take one slice.
You gentlemen can take it on.
Take one slice at a time.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much,
thank
gentlemen.
Thank you.
I have two other people signed up, Tom Lavelle and Christy Wilkins, and you're... Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer and senators, my name is Tom Lovell. I'm the operations manager for Cascade School District. One of the things I oversee is student transportation and our school crossings, and along with various other things in a small community. I've been with the district for 39 years, and unfortunately we've seen some tragedy in our area. We've got country roads out there, lots of traffic. It's getting more congested all the time. I happen to live in the area that we're talking about. My granddaughter's there as a fourth generation from our family. I have a son that teaches there. And I can attest that our school, you know, is right next to the road. Our closest building is within 26 feet of the road, the white line of the road. Our fire marshal has established some of the things that we have to do for fire drills. And one of those is to exit our kids right alongside that road. Our kids are walking the white line right along that road, and cars are doing 55 miles an hour. It's unbelievable. If you would see it, you just couldn't believe it. And, you know, we just feel that, you know, the safety of our kids, we're here today to ask you to pass this bill for the safety of our kids. That's just where it's at. And like I said, unfortunately, we've had several tragedies in our school district. We've got crosses out there. You know, we're lots of corners, narrow roads. It's a tough situation. So anything that you would like to ask, I have quite a bit of history of that school district.
So I assume this is on a county road?
It's a Marion County road, and it actually comes up over a hill. And if you're exiting across from the parking lot, across from the school, you cannot see that person until you're right on top of them.
Wow.
And when those lights go off, it's 55, and you know what people do. They don't drive 55. It's 55 to 60-plus miles an hour.
So do the kids have to cross the road to load into buses?
No, not to load the buses. Oh. You know, luckily we're able to do that. We have a loading zone for them. But if the student has to go to the doctor or comes late or something and there's an overflow, they park in the parking lot across the street, and those parents are exiting their kids across there or bring them across, entering the school there, without any kind of safety. There's 55 mile an hour cars flying by there.
And about half of our students are picked up by parents. Part of the reason for that's a very rural district, and some of the routes are lengthy, and so we have a lot of parents.
Can I get you to put your name on the record?
Sorry. I'm Christy Wilkins. I am the principal of Cloverdale Elementary School.
Thank you.
And I'm also here in support of this bill. And I'm sorry, Tom, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's fine.
I'm just curiosity. I sense we're going to pass this bill today, but have you given any thought to going towards one of the push-activated stop signs or stoplights?
We've talked about that.
Talked about that. That's a funding issue. That's something that Marion County would have to put in there. Again, you know, there's a mixed feeling out there with the community that thinks that we have control over these school zones and flashing lights and crosswalks. The school has no authority. I get calls like that all the time to my office. And I say, I'm sorry, and we deal with Marion County when it's a county road, and if it's in town, it's the city. Mm-hmm. So for Almsville and Turner, we have to deal with the city.
And we've seen this issue kind of as a sequence of events that we need to do to ensure the safety of our children. The first one is to implement what we hope will be implementing the flashing lights from about 7:15 to 2:45 during the school day. That'll get the cars to slow down, and then the illuminated crosswalk, if I'm using the right term, would kind of be the next step. Because as Tom said, the cars, I get there very early in the morning, and I stand out in the parking lot sometimes before the flashing lights are turned on. And one thing I wanted to emphasize is that the flashing lights do work. They are very, very effective. When they are on, drivers slow down. And when they're not, as soon as they go off, and Tom has been out there with me as well and other staff, as soon as those lights are off, cars are speeding significantly above the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. And as there have been growth up in that area, the people that buy and build up there tend to commute, some of them long distances, and they're heading towards I-5, probably most of them. And it's pretty terrifying. So the lights do work. We know that. And we think that this is the best option for now. Would I like to see the speed limit lowered? Absolutely. That would be a good thing. But I think the flashing lights on during the school day would be the most impactful intervention at this point.
It actually might be more effective than just changing the speed limit.
Yeah.
People pay more. It's
That's
sort
right.
of catches your attention.
It does, and they do work.
Although in my community, we've gone, at least in one place, now it's inside a city, where the push-button activated red lights. That worked mm-hmm. pretty well, too. But probably more expensive, you're right. Senator Thompson?
So you're suggesting to them to put pressure on their county commission to put in those stop buttons. That's what I would do.
That's what you would do?
Absolutely.
As a former county commissioner, your recommendation?
That's my recommendation.
Okay. Kevin will send you a thank you note later.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
Commissioner Cameron's been very kind. I don't think we want to go there.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for hearing us today. Thank you.
Trish Smith.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I'll be very brief here in offering OSEA support for House Bill 3035. You are thinking about Cascade School District when you think about this bill, and indeed they brought it to you, and they have every reason to bring it to you, thank heavens for it. But there are many, many school districts across the state that have many, many of these roads with schools on them. And they do need another alternative than the ones that we have now for those roads that have high speeds on them. And so we think this is a good bill. We agree there may be even more improvements that should be made. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about that in a separate piece of legislation and move this one along. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Tricia. I know I wasn't in the legislature when the original stuff was passed in 2005, but I remember listening about it from someone I live with who was here a lot during that. But the one thing I would observe is those lights have gotten quite a bit cheaper, and a lot of them because of the lack of need to put electricity there with solar cells. We're using a lot more of them throughout the areas now.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's true.
Thing.
It's a wonderful thing. And I think as technology continues to advance, we'll have more and more opportunities to make our kids safer in their schools and as they're leaving them.
Questions, Tricia? Thank you very much. That's all I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3035?
Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We'll open the work session. Chair moves House Bill 3035A, right? No, just 3035 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? House Bill 3035 is moved to the Senate floor by unanimous vote with a Duplass recommendation. The carrier. You want to carry?
Sure.
Senator Thompson will carry. We'll close on that. And now where do we go?
Back to the top.
Back to the top. We will, as soon as I see it, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2893.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2893 permits financial institutions to conduct savings promotion raffle subject to specified conditions, allows the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules regarding savings promotion raffles, exempts saving promotion raffles from definition of gambling, becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact.
All right, it's step two, Pamela Levitt and Jeff Kennedy. Easy one, huh?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. We bring to you House Bill 2893, bipartisan bill sponsored by Representative John Davis and Representative Reed and Kenny Guyer. This bill has been in the works for several years, and we're thrilled to have it move out of the House on a 59-0 vote, and I'm excited to tell you about it. I have some brief testimony, and I have Credit Union CEO, and then we have a short video to show you about how exciting this program is. Prize League Savings is a program that was piloted in 2009 in the state of Michigan based on research conducted by a Harvard professor that showed that there was a correlation between people who enjoyed playing the lottery but who definitely didn't have long-term savings accounts. Prize League Savings accounts were created to incentivize those individuals, consumers, to start building their financial strength in their credit union account or their financial account. Credit unions in the United States have a long history of setting up these prize link savings programs. So here's how it works. The consumer will go into their local credit union and open up a $25 CD. They are committed to an annual CD with the threshold generally around $25. They're entered into a monthly drawing, sometimes a quarterly drawing and an annual drawing. So a consumer can deposit those funds. Those funds will always be their funds, but they're entered into a prize. And we have some stories about some wonderful prize winners. In Michigan, which was really our first state to develop this program, 55% of the what we call save to win account holders said that they regularly did not ever have a savings account and saved money. 64% reported that they had never ever opened up a certificate of deposit. 44% reported household incomes of less than $40,000. And 16% reported household incomes of less than 20. We have seen in other states that this program has helped those who are not used to saving, typically a low-income consumer, help build a savings program with really a fun way to save. In short, the program has been successful around the country. PrizeLink savings programs have been set up in Michigan, Nebraska, North Carolina, Washington, Connecticut, New York. Most recently in Washington, the program passed in their legislature in 2013, just over 1 year after the program was started. 950 accounts were opened by six credit unions, and with cash prizes of around $5,000 to those who won the drawings. But the average savings totaled they got up to 1,344 accounts with members collectively saving over $1.3 million in the state of Washington just from those six credit unions opening the program. Congress recently passed, and President Obama signed into law, the American Savings Promotion Act, which also allows banks to provide these programs. So our bill does give the opportunity of both banks and credit unions in Oregon to open up PrizeLink savings. So for the really good details of how it operates inside a credit union, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague.
Great. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Kennedy. I'm the CEO of Twin Star Credit Union. We're based out of Lacey, Washington. Twin Star Credit Union serves over 108,000 members, with a majority living in Washington, Northwest Oregon. We have 20 branches in the state of Washington, as well as branches in Portland and Wilsonville. And I'm here today to offer support for testimony for supporting Bill 2893, the PrizeLink Savings Bill. As Pam mentioned, Twin Star Credit Union was one of the original participants in the Washington Save to Win program that was launched in April of 2013. In the first year of the program, we had 47 winners, and again, those cash prizes range anywhere from $50 to $5,000, and the $5,000 would be for the quarterly and then for the annual savings or for the annual awards. In the first year, we had 47 winners, totaling $17,200, and I've got some information in just a second that will kind of show you with how that compares to actual balances. Last year, we had 50 winners receiving a total of $17,350. We've seen such success with the program that we've actually opened it up to our employees. Employees are not allowed to participate in the statewide program, but we've started one internally. And out of our 350 employees, we now have 63 employees that are contributing monthly to a Save to Win certificate, and they're going to receive an annual award of $500 for a large winner. We do view this as a win-win. This encourages thrift. It also gives them the opportunity to win some extra money. It's designed to have a very broad demographic appeal. Specific features make the product easily accessible to the financially vulnerable members. It successfully attracts low to moderate income families and has positively impacted their savings behavior. So as of today, actually as of last Friday, we had 720 Save to Win accounts, total deposits of little over $430,000. And since inception of the program, we've had over 1,000 accounts from various people that have opened them up. Members that are participating in the program right now have an average balance of $596. So that's kind of the scale. You have five, and again, they're making, most of them are making monthly deposits on average about $130. So if you do win that annual prize, that's a pretty good return on your investment. Most of these people, as Pam stated, have not been regular savers, and most of our winners say they've never won anything. They've never participated in any program like this until they heard about ours. One of our winners, Janet, pretty much says it all. She said, Save to Win has had a huge impact on our family's financial life. We still have debt, but we're paying that off, and as for savings, that's now become a priority. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I encourage your support of House Bill 2893.
Question, Senator Thompson.
Where does money come from the prizes?
That comes from the institutions that are involved. We all pool our funds, if you will, to pay for the prize winnings. Yeah.
Senator
Ryan? I'm sorry.
I was just going to also add that the Northwest Credit Union Association has a foundation, and the foundation also supports some funding for those prizes.
Right. Senator Riley?
The question I had was, in your organization, does this go into CDs, or is it just into the savings account, or is it both?
Sorry. Quick answer, it goes into a certificate account.
Thank you. Yes,
okay, here, this is just a two-minute video.
Video first.
I think anybody can save $25 to start, and that's really where we started. We did an automatic draft of $25.
I dreamed of it every month, to be honest with you. It was in my mind. Every time I would deposit it, I would say, I'm going to win this.
We've heard that this is the first savings program that people think that actually sticks in their household, where they actually can go with it for more than a few months.
This puts an element of fun and adventure into savings. That's what we want to do. We want to teach savings. We want to teach how, if you're consistent, how it builds up.
We would put money in our regular savings, but then something would
would happen and we'd pull it out. And so with the Save to Win, the last ditch effort would be we would not pull that money out because we didn't want to be taken out of the contest.
I gave a good scream. No one was home. And I gave a good scream because it was wonderful.
He thought it was something bad. And so I said, don't be so negative. And he texts back, we won $5,000. And I text back, yep, we did.
I think the people who have signed up for Save to Win at Connection Credit Union are folks who do not have a consistent savings account.
When a household is able to start with a savings account, it does provide some confidence that they can do more. It provides some stability and security that they can withstand a challenging time. And I think that just gives our whole community an advantage in that people have a better control over where they're going with their money and they feel better about their future.
Then once you had, you know, the 250 or 300, you just immediately start wanting more, you know, in a positive way.
It always makes sense to have extra money for numerous things that can happen. Absolutely, it makes sense.
It's encouraged about 500 of our members to start savings when they hadn't. So I'd say it's achieved all the goals, yeah.
Senator's
Yeah, it's kind of a novel concept, I have to admit. But it seems to me like the returns that you could generate is what's going to draw the people to save. So I was just, you know, why not put a link to Powerball or something like that where, I mean, you're talking more than $5,000. You're just saying, you know, the bank will invest 10 tickets of Powerball every month or something like that. I just was kind of thinking outside the box.
Senator, I believe that's illegal in the state of Washington.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
It's all legal in the state of Washington as well.
Let's say guarantee a winner.
Well, not so you're not guaranteeing a winner by any stretch.
Yeah.
That would be illegal.
You would have to, you mean buy them for the person?
No. You're buying it as a group. That's what this is. I mean, it's a group liability. So you buy it as a group, and then you'd share the wealth if you won.
It's among all of them.
Yeah.
Senator, was that a question?
No. No, I'm on a roll today.
So, Pam, people deposit in the savings account $25 a month, and they get to keep that. And in lieu of getting any interest, they get a chance at earning, at winning a prize.
So, actually, Senator, they do receive interest on it, so the interest is guaranteed. And it's
they still get some interest on their deposit.
Yes, sir.
Plus a chance of winning.
Yes, sir. And for every $25 increment of deposits into that certificate, they receive one entry, and they can have up to 10. Or if they put $250 per month into that certificate, they get 10 entries. It's capped at 10.
Chair Beyer and Senator Monroe, the concept is this is your money. This and it's a regular account. There, the incentive is the possible prize, and that's for you to keep putting money in.
But you can't pay people the normal interest rate that you would pay and also give them a chance at these prizes.
Why not?
It doesn't work out economically.
Well, they say it does because it increases sales.
That's,
and it does.
Yeah. Chair Byron, Senator, I'm learning the protocol, so forgive me, private sector, I'm not familiar how all this works. That's exactly the way the program works. They do get the market rate of interest on the 12-month CD, and they do have the opportunity to win.
I'm impressed they get interest.
Well, I
don't get interest on anything anymore.
I mean, the money has to come from someplace.
Marketing budgets, foundation. Mm-hmm.
Did you not hear that they get a million extra dollars into their mm-hmm. into their institution? Didn't you not hear that part?
Senator Thompson.
Just a comment. I like this savings idea to get people to save much better than Treasurer Wheeler's idea.
That would be my idea.
Oh, that was your idea? God. I gave him credit. I didn't know that.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's the last time you get recognized.
Mr. Chairman, this is my last meeting on this committee.
Senator Riley. Yeah, one actual question. Is this for new account holders, or is it for anybody, including older account holders, whatever?
Mm-hmm. Senator Byron, Chair Byron, and Senator Riley. It's open to any one of the members,
okay,
whether new or existing.
Mm-hmm.
Any member except
employee. Yeah, there's a couple of exclusions.
Yes.
And Senator Thompson. Yeah.
Yeah, you'll like this question. So your credit union is doing this up there, and other people are hearing about it, I'm sure. Do you see other banks, other credit unions doing this kind of thing too? Is it kind of catching on?
Senator Beyer and Senator Thompson, as I said, it's spread in six states. There are actually, I believe the last count was four or five other legislatures considering this legislation. So it is spreading around the country. As soon as it opens in Oregon, obviously we have credit unions with connections in both Washington and Oregon. I'm sure there are several Oregon credit unions. And, I'm sure it will be appealing, I hope, to the banking industry too.
Thank you.
I just have one question. Pam, and
yes.
This is, I'm reading in the major summary,
yes,
about the constitutional prohibition on,
yes,
lotteries and all that.
I had that pulled up.
I can't figure out how you skin the cat on that one.
If let me pull it back up. I just closed my...
says it states that the Constitution prohibits...
I believe, so Senator, Chair Beyer, this is why this issue has taken so long, is the question of, is this a lottery? And I believe that legislative counsel answered that in the last sentence by saying PrizeLink savings appear to lack the element of consideration since the raffle entrant does not risk anything of value or need to pay to play. And, I would say that you need to bring in legislative counsel for the highly technical issues on this, but that is how I have determined that they have said this is not a lottery. Over the course of the last 4 or 5 years that I've been working on this bill with other legislators, that question has come up, and we have resolved it by this is the
consumer.
You're
not buying the raffle ticket.
Right, exactly.
No risk.
Okay, seems like an argument that would only fool an attorney, but we'll go with it. Senator Monroe.
I'm still trying to figure out where the prize money comes from. People deposit the money. You pay them book rate of interest, the same rate that anybody else would get if they weren't a part of this program. So is the advertising value of this program enough to pay for the prizes?
Yes.
Chair Byron, Senator, I would say the answer is absolutely.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I think I've got it figured out now. Thank you.
You're good. Okay. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. That's all I had signed up to testify on House Bill 2893. Is there anybody else? Seeing none, we will close public hearing, open work session. Chair moves House Bill 2893 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. A discussion on the motion? No? Anybody else? Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. House Bill 2893 moves to the Senate floor by unanimous vote with a do pass recommendation, and the chair will carry this one. We'll close on that. Let's see. We're done. We're open on House Bill 2912.
Senator Monroe support.
Say what?
That's the first gambling bill I've seen Senator Monroe support since I've been on the committee.
gambling with somebody else's money. You're up, James.
Very good. Thanks, what bill is that? 2912? Which bill did you?
Oh, we opened 2912. We're following your instructions.
Very
James.
Good. House Bill 2912A repeals obsolete laws related to transportation and motor vehicle laws, declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments, no revenue impact, and has a minimal fiscal impact.
And who do I got here? No, I threw the wrong one away. Ted Rollinger. It must be right. We've got legislative counsel. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We haven't had you in front of us yet this year.
Not this year. This is the first time. Then this is a very exciting bill, too.
Okay.
I'm Ted Reutlinger with Legislative Council. I am just here to explain to you how this bill made its way to your committee. House Bill 2912 amends, repeals, outdated, obsolete, and duplicative laws relating to transportation and motor vehicles. And it got to you because in 2014, the legislature passed a bill, House Bill 4133, which directed legislative counsel and the Department of Justice to review and identify general laws that are obsolete, outdated, or duplicative of other laws. And so legislative counsel during the interim worked with DOJ and state agencies in the governor's office to identify a host of laws that met that criteria. In the transportation area, these are the laws that we came up with. This bill required us to draft then a report that identified each law that we're changing and tell you why in the report we're changing that particular law. Those notes are included in this bill following each section, so it tells you what we're doing and why. As I said, we worked with the governor's office, the Department of Transportation. Everybody signed off on the contents of the bill, and that is how it got to be before you today. I'm happy to try and answer any questions you might have.
Looks like it had enough sledding in the house.
Yeah.
Questions at 10? Seeing none. Thank you, Ted.
You're welcome.
Anybody else wish to testify on the bill? That's happy. Truckers are happy. Transit's happy. God, everybody's just a love fest here. We'll close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2912A. Chair moves adoption of House Bill 29A, moving to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
2912A.
Did I say that? Didn't say that. All right. So discussion on the motion.
I would love to carry this one.
All right. Is there any opposition to the motion?
It's worth a bunch of questions on the floor.
Yeah.
This is a technical bill. We'll close on, let's see, I didn't say that right. I better say it first. House Bill 2912A is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. No members in opposition. And Senator Riley wishes to carry. So now we'll close on that.
Let me ask you to come sit.
All right, so that one's Riley. Now we're down to 3062, right?
Correct.
We'll open on House Bill 3062. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3062 exempts prepaid transportation cards from Uniform Disposition of Unclaimed Property Act and related statutes and from provisions related to regulation of gift cards with expiration dates. There are no amendments, it has no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Attendees, Chris Tucker. This is obviously a bad idea.
I thought we were saving the best for last.
It's a simple one.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee, thanks for having us. And this is Chris Tucker. He's our Director of Revenue Operations at TriMet and our resident expert in the subject. So I'm here to ease him into it.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Again, my name is Chris Tucker, Director of Revenue Operations at TriMet in Portland, Oregon. TriMet provides public transportation throughout the greater Portland metropolitan region. And I'm here as the project leader for an electronic fare collection system, or eFare for short, and to request approval of House Bill 3062. And that will allow TriMet to retain all the fare revenue that it collects, just like we do today. As background, I'd like to explain how TriMet currently collects fares and contrast that with the proposed e-fare system, which TriMet plans to implement in 2016. E-fare is a payment system that will better serve our riders by allowing them to pay as they board a bus or a train with a transit debit card. Essentially, they take the card and they tap and they ride. Instead of fumbling with cash or needing to purchase a pass at the grocery store, they simply tap and board the vehicle. The system also has a myriad of other customer benefits, such as balance protection. Also, if someone loses the card, they can shut that down and be able to keep the value they have. They have the ability to reload value online anytime, anywhere, and less waiting time because of the streamlined boarding process of tapping that card. So to support this new way to pay, the system creates a transit account for the customer, and they can store money in that account for future usage. So they just add value and they store it onto that account, similar to how a bank account works, but it's by no means a bank account. The system tracks usage, which allows riders to verify their charges and the balance remaining on their account. Our e-fare project is similar to the electronic fare collection projects in Seattle, Salt Lake City, San Francisco, and many others. Like the transit agencies in those systems, we have encountered a problem with the way state law treats unused fare revenue and proposed similar legislative solution. The problem, because cash and paper fares are valid at the time of sale today, TriMet recognizes the revenue at the point of sale and retains it as fare revenue. So that's how it works today. Unlike the current cash fare system, with e-fare, TriMet will not record a fare as revenue until it's actually used. Because the unused balance on e-fare card is considered unearned revenue, it would be subject to Oregon's unclaimed property law and would escheat to the state after a certain period of inactivity, which means TriMet would lose that revenue to the state of Oregon. The solution is House Bill 3062, modeled after similar laws in other states. HB 3062 would exclude transit fare card balances from the unclaimed property and gift card statutes. Thus, instead of losing unused fare card balances to the state, TriMet would retain the revenue for public transportation in a manner similar to how it retains all fare revenue currently. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Chris, I'm kind of surprised that this falls under, I mean, the statute you referenced was the gift cards, where I'm going to give somebody a $50 gift and I give it to them. I would say that what you're talking about is what I have on my phone. I have a little thing, TriMet, where I can go in, go online and load it up, and then I just take this and I click it when I want a ticket, and it's the same kind of thing. Or it seems similar to the way we, frankly, do food stamps, where we give people, in essence, a loadable debit card, and we give them their monthly amount, and they use it until it's empty. So, okay. And it's refillable. That's not the same as a gift card, where a gift card, you buy it at a face value, and you use it until it's gone, and you throw it away.
Or you could, or there are those that you can refill, like my Starbucks card.
Ah, that's a good example.
Mm-hmm. So, Chair Byard,
the distinction we made in the law is really doesn't respond very well to gift cards.
So, Chair Byard, members of the committee, today what we have is a paper-based system that doesn't have expiration dates. So most of our fares, while some are on the phone, most of them are paper-based tickets. What happens is we don't know when those would be used, and they just sit there and they're always available for use, literally for decades. You could turn those in and they don't expire. But with stored value, there's specifically electronically measured store value. We have to leave it as unearned revenue because we know it exists and we have it tied to a record. And now that we have that electronic information, it sits there as unearned revenue, and it will follow that unclaimed property law. So it does mean that we go through the whole escheatment process for 3 years to identify the rightful owners, and then the money goes to the state. So unfortunately, that's the way that we'll have to respond to it in the new world without this.
So they say that again. So with the gift cards, I don't remember the timing, but we had a deal where they would go a certain amount of time, and then that money came to the state, had to be given to the state. Would that be the same issue? So if you had one of those TriMet cards and it was loaded up for $20 and nobody used it for 10 years, what do you do with it?
That's right. So currently what will happen after 3 years with these new e-fare cards is it goes to the state.
It escheats
to the state.
And you can, as the person who paid for that card, you can go to the state and get your money back. You just have to fill out a form.
And that's true of a gift card as well.
That's true of anything that they escheat.
Oh, well. Okay, questions. We're sort of asking them, but
so this will open the precedent of other groups coming in.
This is a carve out.
Senator Thompson, it is specific to transportation.
Right. And if I might add, there are also Chair Byron, Vice Chair. There are also other prepaid telephone cards and a few other things are already in statute. Yeah, we're already addressed to this. We're just adding ours to the list.
Senator Riley?
Yeah. You talk about it as unusable revenue, but it's not revenue until it's used. Is that correct?
Senator Riley, today we don't have any mechanism to know when the paper ticket will be used.
I'm
so
about paper
we
ticket.
Recognize it immediately.
He's talking about the cards only.
I'm talking about the new e-tickets.
Yeah, so in the future, if it'll sit there as unearned revenue without being used, it'll just sit there for however many years.
But it's prepaid, is that correct?
That's correct.
So, may I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So, if I put $100 into a prepaid transit card,
that's
and then I don't use some of it for some period of time, 3 years, I guess we're saying, it'll disappear.
Did we do that, Bill?
So what will happen under this is we're able to retain the records for several years for any customers that come back to ask for the money back. But what we won't do after 3 years is we won't be directed to give the revenue to the state. Instead, we'll be able to retain it along with the information for the customer. We can recognize it as revenue, just like we do today. We recognize it as revenue immediately. We'll be able to recognize it as revenue years down the road from a policy perspective, and we'll retain the records of the customers. And then if they come back and ask for that money back, we can, from a policy perspective, just refund the money to them.
But it doesn't say that in the bill.
That's right. From a policy perspective, it does not. Just like today, there is no policy. We just honor it if they come back to us.
So if somebody brings tickets back today, will you give them money?
So, Chair Beyer, a good example, in 2012, we did a ticket exchange of all tickets in the history of TriMet that went back essentially 40 years, and we did an exchange for every customer that came in and gave them a new ticket that was good for the new fare system and new structure. So essentially they never expired.
Senator Riley?
But what happened to the ones for the people who didn't come in?
They still have them, and on occasion we will get a call and the customer service manager still honors those and does an exchange.
But what if they just go and get on the MAX and that's the ticket they've got?
Well, it depends. So technically speaking, they're not valid anymore. We used to have what's called a zone system where it would, and so when the zone system went away, they would need to exchange those tickets.
That's too narrow.
Okay.
Sort of like the forever stamp, huh?
Yeah, I'm honestly not always that happy with this bill. It's not giving. It's the on every other kind of thing that you pay for, and later you don't pick it up. There's the escheat to the state, and I've used this myself. You can go look online and fill out a form and ask the state if you have any money sitting around that they've escheated, and if they do, they'll send you a check for it. And this would do away with that for this particular card.
If I might add, Senator Beyer, currently if you purchase fares from us, say you buy a book of stamps, book of stamps, a book of tickets, and you lose all of them but one, then you've lost them and you actually can't replace them. What this system will do for us is allow us to, when people purchase fares from us, they're purchasing public transportation for us, and then we provide it to them in the increments that they purchased it. So what this is allowing us to do is take that similar system and advance it to our new e-fare system. If we were required to escheat that to the state, we would essentially be giving up the revenue that people have already given to us.
Excuse me, but they haven't given you revenue. They've given you money, and they haven't used that the what they've paid for yet, and so it's not revenue until they use it. So you're not keeping revenue. You're keeping the money that someone has put up front in for future purchases. I read it differently than you do, that's all.
Okay. Senator Rudd?
Yeah, I, they came up, and I got to tell you, I have no problems with the bill and the concept of the bill. The problem I have is the underlying statute, as we talked about up in my office. I mean, the underlying statute, we went after businesses and stole their money from them, basically, on unclaimed credit cards. This is asking for a carve-out and an extent of a bill I didn't really support the first time through. So it's a carve-out, and I understand the want for a carve-out, but government and government entities shouldn't be asking for carve-outs when you stole it from the private business sector as well.
Well, actually, you didn't steal it from the private sector. You stole it from whoever was gifted the money to. It didn't belong to the business. It belonged to the individual.
It was unclaimed. So it was you actually did steal it from the private business sector.
I would differ with you on that.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
That's what his cheats are all about.
I think this is one we're going to have to think about a little bit. So thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Hearing none, we will close the public hearing.
You've got a guy out there that wants to testify.
Oh, he does. I'm sorry. We'll reopen. You weren't quick enough.
You just didn't look at me.
Welcome.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Edward McLowe, and I represent Lane Transit District. And in Eugene, our reflexes are slower than they are in Portland, so you'll have to forgive me. The reason why I'm up here testifying on this bill is just to kind of raise the flag that this bill is a statewide issue and not just a TriMet issue. At Lane Transit District, we're still in the paper fare age, but we've got a work group that is beginning the process to look at electronic fares with the desire to move that way in the next 3 to 5 years or so. Really, it's a desire to improve the service for our customers that in a town dominated by a university of 24,000 millennials, the need to keep up with the modern age is a tremendous strain on our system. For a community of 250,000 people, that's 10% of our population. We do about 11 million rides a year, and nearly half of them are students. So our ridership is looking for the flexibility to use advancements in technology. As we look at that to be more competitive in the transportation market, we're also looking at the legal challenges ahead for implementation, and this is one of those. I understand that there are differing perspectives, as the committee has discussed today, on the value of that. Kind of the way that we see this is that, you know, currently when people purchase our fares, as Aaron from TriMet testified, they purchase access to the system and pay that in advance. We have no way of tracking whether or not they use that fare. In essence, it's like buying a ticket or a bracelet to go to Oaks Park for the day. Whether or not I go there for an hour or six, there's no tracking of that. People get to withdraw from their account as they use it. That's the added value of this system for us. The ability for us to keep that money in an account and on file instead of sending it back to the state after a set period of time means that they can continue to use their bracelet, or in this case, you know, electronic swipe card, to get on the system or call our customer service and retrieve the value of their card directly from us instead of going through a different process. So that money is always there and tracking with them as the client, as opposed to in a different process where we wouldn't be able to do that. So this lifts a number of regulatory burdens that would make it easier for our system. There are other transit systems in the state as well that are looking at moving towards electronic fares. And so I just wanted to be sure that the committee was aware this is a broader issue that affects all of public transit. Thank you.
Thank you. I think the issue is not really, it's really an accounting problem for you, and it's an accounting problem for others. It's when you sold the card, you've sold the service. Mm-hmm. And the question is when somebody uses it. You know, I differ with my friend here in terms of what we did with the private. We did change that, and the question is should a public agency be treated differently than somebody else? It's really, how do you bookkeep it? You know, if Toys R Us sells a $25 credit card, at some point down the road, they're expected to do that, to provide a toy at that point or give the money back.
Yes, Senator Beyer, members of the committee.
So it's an accounting problem whether you have to have that hold on in your book as a contingent liability or...
Well, or the state will take it after a certain
time. Or the state will take it.
Yeah.
Senator Beyer, but it doesn't belong to the... It no longer belongs to you. You just have an obligation to provide a service.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the difference we see is that our service is access to a system, as opposed to Toys R Us, where I can buy a Jeffrey the Giraffe for my nephew. I don't gain anything necessarily from access to the system. There's not a limit to it. So my $1.75 fare buys me 2 hours of access onto LTD unlimitedly, so I can get onto 7 different buses. I could get onto 1 bus, and so there's not a product difference. In addition, with our paper fares, it's really to us a question of fare media, that a paper fare has no tracking. And there's no expectation of return on that, whereas the electronic fare there is. So we want to standardize that.
Okay. Questions, Edward? Seeing none, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing. We will carry this over. And I think we're done for the day.
Great.